So we're continuing with our exploration of the paramis. So these are the 10 perfections. So Sue's offered a talk last week on the first one on this month, which is truthfulness. So I'll continue with this exploration. And so truthfulness is such a kind of a big word that sometimes, yeah, but it's also a very significant word in this whole tradition, because we almost define all of Dharma practice is about learning how to connect with what's true, what's actually here instead of our projections into the present moment, our biases, all those things that distort the way we actually have access to how things actually are. Our meditation practice, such simplicity, just meeting what this moment actually is, meeting the breath, meeting the sensations which are arising, meeting the sound. We start to develop this relationship to what's true in this moment, the truth of how things are arising and things passing away. Now, I like to, often at the beginning of these, each month, is kind of look at the relationship between the month's parami and all the other ones. So the previous month was around patience. And patience has this interesting quality of learning to simply be with this moment, actually sustaining it. And we might feel like we're impatient, we're going to go do something different, but that patience allows us to sit with it long enough to actually connect with how it actually is. It starts to have this sense of clarity that arises from it. And the first couple of paramis of generosity and ethical conduct has this effect of kind of calming down the system. Because if we're always kind of churned up with turmoil, with harming and, you know, stealing and all these different things, inwardly we're also very noisy, right? If our hearts are really contracted with selfishness and lack, it's really hard to have that sense of calmness, the sense of openness. So those two paramis really help to bring this quality of truthfulness to start to arise, but it's almost calming the whole system down. Now, truthfulness we can define almost in two broad categories. One is the not speaking of a falsehood, not speaking something which isn't true. And this is a really important aspect. The other aspect is trying to develop this connection with what is true and how do we express that? How do we actually manifest what is true? So we'll use those two aspects to tackle this tonight. So first of all, the sense of the falsehood, speaking that which isn't true. So if you remember the five precepts, this is one of the core precepts. You know, to refrain, undertake the training to refrain from speaking that which is not true. Now, this is defined in the negative often, and sometimes we struggle with that. We kind of like the positive expressions, which, you know, really help our hearts engage. But there's also this sense of the having kind of almost this boundary with our actions. Okay, because sometimes what's true, we can debate that. But knowing what's false is a little easier to say. Like we know something, okay, I'm not speaking what is true in this moment. I actually did take that extra cookie. I actually did this certain transgression. Remember Sharon Salzberg when she came one year to teach here at Seattle Insight. She reflected that when she first started to teach the metta phrases, so the loving kindness phrases, we typically think of them today as like, may I be safe and protected, may I be peaceful, may I be live with ease. But the traditional phrases are actually voiced a little bit more in the negative, like may I be free of external and internal danger. And after she kind of presented those, there was this long line of people coming up to talk to her to convince her to be more positive, to kind of have that positive manifestation that we love so much in the West. But I think it's also helpful to just reflect on that, the wisdom of having that kind of like, this is understanding that when you speak something that's untrue, there's a consequence to that. There's an internal consequence. There's a consequence with your actions. And that's one of the wings of the homework today, is to explore that, to start to become more and more aware during this month. So just when you start to say something which is a little bit untrue, not quite accurate, notice what comes up in your inner experience. Start to notice how the body tenses up, how there's a a contraction of the heart. There's a little bit of it being a little bit, you know, is someone going to catch me in that lie? And also notice when you're saying something that's aligned with how things actually are, how that feels very different in the body. So I like to think of it not so much as a rule that we need to follow, but more as learning to see why is this maybe a good thing to follow through your own direct experience. This is also a manifestation of what's true is you see it for yourself. There's a whole different way of integrating and understanding this. Now, this precept of not speaking falsehood, not speaking that which isn't true. Often when I give a retreat, I like to broaden that to our internal dialogue. Because how often do our internal dialogue is filled with statements which perhaps aren't so true about ourselves, about another person? Like that old, one of the first things I learned when I did my work in therapy was understanding around global statements. Like, I'm always this way. You know, I'm never going to be able to. You know, as you start to hear yourself say that, is that really true? Is that true that this person will never be this way or will always be a certain way? For ourselves internally, too. That healthy, that strong self-critic, you know, the voices that gives us, is that really true? To start to expand that, okay, am I really saying something true in this moment? When am I believing in it? Now, this falsehood piece, the Buddha really emphasized this quite a bit. And there's this really lovely sutta where he's talking to his son, who I think it was 6 or maybe 8 years, something like that, very young, to ordain. He actually became like a novice monk and was practicing with the Buddha, with his father. And apparently he told something that wasn't quite true. He told a little fib or lied about something. And the Buddha sat him down and, you know, they washed their feet and he said, okay, look at this bowl here and how much water is left in this bowl, right? How much left is how much is left of your own virtue, your own good conduct when you tell a lie. And he emphasized it. He turned it upside down and seeing all that water is left out. That's just how much of your own merit, your own kind of the alignment of your own inner authority is left after you tell a lie. And he goes on to finally say there's nothing that's outside of the capacity of someone who's willing to lie. So in other words, if you start to lie, there's this distortion of the truth. Any other harm becomes much more possible because you're negating how things actually are. And this is such a lovely practice to start to notice. When do you want to start to tell something that's not quite true? Sometimes you're doing it to kind of help kind of grease the wheels of social interactions. You know, if someone doesn't really want to hear the truth of how you're saying, or you're having a really the most worst day in your life, and you might just say, I'm okay. You know, something like that. You don't really want to go into the details. I remember my daughter, when she was in high school, she played the clarinet, and one day she forgot her clarinet, and she told her teacher that she was in the shop getting fixed, so she would get points off. And I said, you know, you actually should email him and tell him that that wasn't true. And she didn't appreciate that in the moment. But the email that came back from the teacher was like, you don't usually get this kind of an email from a student, that they were willing to own up to saying something wasn't quite true. I was just at a Mariners game over the weekend with my brother who was visiting, and I was focusing on something about the game, and he said, okay, do you see that Mexican flag that someone's displaying? And I didn't really see it, but I didn't really want to look for it. So I just said that I saw it. But I could feel as soon as I did that, there was this internal shift that was really, it wasn't very pleasant. There was like this almost a fracturing of disconnection with how things actually were. There's a contraction of the heart, a heaviness of that, you know, of really breaking that kind of that relationship a little bit. So as you do this, use it as a learning. You start to learn, okay, maybe I tell lies in certain circumstances, and maybe sometimes that's kind of, it's okay, maybe it's for the better good, or it's out of compassion. But notice when you start to do it out of a sense of protection, or trying to avoid something, or you're trying to hide something, and just pause with that. Pause to see if there's maybe a way to align yourself with what's true. So this first aspect of learning how to really have this greater clarity about what is true and what is not true. The Buddha really emphasized this in his teachings. Because if we don't have a relationship to what's true and we speak what's false, there's so much harm that can be caused from that. And it sets up a relationship to life that really anything can come from that. That's harmful. Now, to understand when we're telling something that's a lie or untrue, we also have to start to develop this relationship to what is true. You know, what is true in this moment? What is true in this my experience? What's true in my heart? So let's explore this a little bit. And as I was reflecting with this talk, there's kind of different levels of truth. There's kind of the relative truth in this moment. Maybe it's a superficial truth in this moment. And there's also a deeper truth, or maybe even an absolute truth, that's also can be touched upon. So the relative truth of this moment, we could go around and I could ask you to point report real time what your inner experience is like. You know, perhaps mind lost in daydream. Maybe there's a sense of agitation. Maybe there's a sense of pressure in the chest. Maybe there's a calmness. But as soon as we say that, that moment's experience has already shifted. There's a new moment that's arising. So it's almost hard to stay connected, you know, caught up as the moment is unfolding. It's like Heraclitus, the Greek philosopher, said you can't step in the same river twice because it's not the same river and you're not the same person. You know, things are flowing down. And this is an interesting way to relate to truth or what's true in this moment, because it is something that arises and then fades. There's this breath, that's the moment that's true, and it falls away. And as meditators, we start to, especially when you start to open to other aspects of our experience around emotions, around beliefs and thoughts, we can start to develop a different relationship to what our mind says is true. We start to become a little bit more skeptical, or a little bit more, we just suspend our belief and our conviction in our thoughts and our emotions. We can realize that, because we see emotions coming and going. It's like, sometimes you ask, how is your day going? It's like, okay, which microsecond do you want me to report on it around that? You know, like a simple example is if you're in an argument with a friend or your partner or a spouse, whoever it might be, and you really care about this person, but in the moment, you really don't like them very much because you're really caught in that. So there's the truth of that moment. Okay, I don't really like this person. But that's the emotion. That's the hurt. That's the kind of the triggering that's happened. Acknowledging that, then we have access to this much deeper truth that, okay, there is this connection, there is this love that's underneath. The absolute truth is much harder to articulate because in some ways it goes beyond words. It's something that we can, and that's, I think that's where we often get caught in, is this display between the relative truth and each person's relative truth and the actual absolute truth. We confuse which is which. We often confuse our beliefs and our opinions with truth. This is actually one of the fetters that the Buddha talked about, is belief and views and opinions. There's a kind of classic analogy or story here of, this is about really, it's about an elephant, like an elephant, let's say it's in the middle of this room. And then let's say we all had lost our sight and we're kind of get a hold of one part of that elephant. When we feel that elephant through our tactile sense, we have a very strong sense of what that elephant is. And yet those who are on the tail are going to have a very different experience than those who are on the horn, or what they call the tusk of the elephant, or the ear of the elephant, or the trunk of the elephant, or the leg of the elephant, or the body, the skin. And in this kind of classic analogy, if we were really caught in our opinions around our experience and what's true, we would argue with it. This is what an elephant is. An elephant is like a spear. No, an elephant is more like a tree trunk. Elephant is more like this kind of vegetation, this leafy vegetation, or it's more like a snake. And this is so often what happens, is we have this limited view of the world, because we have our own biases, we have our own limited experiences, and yet that's what we believe is true. The studies around explicit bias, I think, is so revealing, or implicit bias, I should say. This is the bias that we don't realize is happening. There's actually studies online, you can go and do a little test, that they show you different images and you kind of react quickly, like liking or disliking, basically. And they have ones around like right race, black and white, or they have around, I think, around gender or on body size, and all these different things that we don't realize that we're projecting upon the world. This is unconsciousness that comes forth. There it is. My wife and I, we learned this process before we got married, around this inner dialogue, or this dialogue with each other. And it was so helpful early on in our relationship. We kind of had to kind of learn to navigate ourselves and learn to connect with each other. And basically, any time that we felt like we got stuck, we got an argument, our hearts kind of closed to each other, we would do this process of really listening deeply to each other. So one person would share, and that person would just reflect and paraphrase what had been said, right? So the person who's speaking actually confirmed, okay, yeah, you got it, or no, you missed my point. Let me say it this way, until they finally got it. And at first, this is kind of torturous, right? And part of the torture of it was that being caught in my own view. Okay, this is my view. I'm right. You're wrong. You know, of course, you should always put the toilet paper this way instead of that way, or, you know, unload the dishwasher this way or that way. Sometimes it just seems you dig in your heels around it so strongly. There's such a sense of, I know what is right, and you don't. But doing this process, it was so lovely to feel this shift from this opinionation, this deep conviction in my own truth, and really listening to her side, actually have her articulate, and for me to actually listen enough to be able to reflect accurately back to her. As I did that, I was able to start to let go of my own belief and my views. I was able to it was interesting to watch that this interaction, the truth of it, changed from my truth and my opinionation to the truth of this kind of shared experience, this shared relationship. And that was so valuable and so helpful in our practice, in our relationship. Now, when you feel yourself kind of caught in something you really believe is true, right? And this is going to be truth when it's really, I think, in a mature sense, you don't really need to argue about it, right? You just kind of know it is true. There's a sense of subtleness. There's not a sense of having to defend it or justify it. But when we feel like we're really kind of caught by something, using some of the techniques of investigation can be very helpful, because we all have our kind of our deep belief in thinking, in our deep love of what we believe is true. A spiritual teacher named Byron Katie developed a very skillful way to work with this. When you feel like I'm really caught in something, you basically ask four liberating questions. You ask your first question, is this true? Is this actually true? Okay, so it's kind of calling out that, of course, you believe it's true, but okay, is it really true? Can you absolutely know that it's true? So it's going a little deeper. So you can start to see the relative nature of truth. How do you react when you believe that thought? Okay, so truth, we believe in that. We start to notice how do we react when we believe in that. And who would you be without the thought? Who would you be without the thought? So if you really take this on, it can have this profound effect of really liberating yourself around it, or something that feels untractable. I was at a Sangha meeting, and one of the teachers at the breakfast sitting, he actually started to talk to us about this, about Byron Katie's work, and how he had a friend who was on a retreat once, and they came to the lunch line, and there was a sign that said, there'd be no meal served in this meal. And something about undo the work around it. All right, so as you think, okay, there's no meal served. You know, how could they do that? I'm going to starve. I'm not going to have enough energy. Is this true? Can I know it's absolutely true? How do I react when I believe in that thought? Who would you be without that thought? So if they took it on, and that's how I think Katie would actually do that a lot, or Byron Katie would do that a lot, kind of throw in these kind of trickster things. And apparently the next meal, the same sign was up. And so then, you know, this comes up again, like, okay, I'm definitely not going to have enough food. I'm going to definitely starve. I'm going to become very, you know, lightheaded. Again, is this true? Do you absolutely know it's true? And apparently that happened for like another two meals. So my friend, Matthew, he said, and by the way, breakfast, we're having trouble with breakfast this morning at Spirit Rock, but we were able to get something eventually. But what this is trying to point to is when we really believe something is true, I think it's helpful to notice, how do we know that's true? What's kind of the mechanism behind it? Because often, if we look honestly, it's our thoughts around it. And behind the thoughts is our conditioning. It's how we were raised, how we were cultured, how we were particularly taught to view things in a certain way. And learning to kind of free that up is so beneficial. There's this short poem I love to read, that everything we see carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. So everything we see carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. Walking the yard with coffee cooling in my hand, I stop at a single seed of hawksbeard balanced on a blade of grass. Except for paying attention, what else is continual prayer? So what am I believing is true? This is the effect of kind of releasing the world from our beliefs, releasing it from our kind of our projections. And it's not only the world, of course. It often starts internally. And we start to learn to release our own inner projections, our own holding, these deep beliefs of who I am and what I am. We start to question that. Because as we meditate, We have all our mind stuff going on. We also have more and more access to the real-time information of how the body actually is, how the mind actually is in this moment. And at some point, that scale shifts. Our belief in our thoughts shifts into kind of this deep affection, this deep love, really, for the present moment's experience. And we just start to become much lighter with our thoughts, lighter with what we think is true. And we start to get a sense of what's true, then there's this expression of it, speaking truthfully. We can think of it as almost three gateways that a word or something we want to say has to pass through for it to be really skillful. The first one is it true? So is it my belief? Is it my opinion? Or is it some, you know, maybe a statement of how something I've done or my actions owning up to something. I lied about this, or I stole that, or I wasn't as kind as I could be in that moment. Or maybe it's expression of, this is what I'm feeling, this is what's arising in this moment's experience. The second gateway is of, is it beneficial? Is it beneficial? Is it actually helpful for this person to hear this? And this is a tricky one, right? Because we kind of all know what's better, best for everybody else around us, right? If they just followed our instructions, they'd be so much happier. But really beneficial, sometimes it's helpful for people to have their own struggle, to have their own timing of exploration. I mean, how many times have someone told you something over and over and over again, and you just kind of let it go by until you actually see it for yourself? When you see it for yourself, that's when it actually sticks. That's when it actually, okay, this is, I can connect with this. And finally, the timing of it. You know, what's the right timing of sharing this, of connecting? Noticing when the person has the capacity to hear, when do you have that sense of balance, when you're not so kind of fuming with that emotion, when I be more clear-headed. And so these three are actually very helpful instructions to look at. And I like to, whenever I can, if I have an email that I need to write that's a little bit more charged or I feel triggered by something, I like to pause with that. I like to kind of let myself maybe draft it without the recipient put in there. So in case I accidentally hit send, it doesn't go anywhere. And I can kind of work with it. Sometimes I can maybe do a couple drafts. Or I like to have my wife, or I often have Tori look at these emails and say, okay, how does this sound? Does it sound too charged, or is it too reactionary? And often that helps us kind of have more access to our own compassion. Now, truthfulness is also interesting. You know, one spiritual teacher said whenever he talked about truthfulness and speaking what's true, inevitably there'd be people in the parking lot, couples who would be kind of telling the other person their truth about that person. Like, let me tell you about yourself, what you're not seeing about yourself. But that kind of projection outward, I think, you know, it's, again, it's relative. You know, ask for permission. You know, can I share something? Know the timing of it. Is it really beneficial? And the Buddha's bar for beneficial is, this help lead to liberation? Does this help to lead to liberation? Now, truthfulness, if you look at some of the suttas, a lot of the suttas anyway, were around a dialogue with the Buddha. The Buddha would come, someone would come up to the Buddha and ask a question about their practice, about their mind, about life. How do I find some ease, some sense of liberation in that? And sometimes the Buddha would not answer the person. He would just stay quiet because he would sense, okay, if I really told them, they wouldn't be able to hear it, or they would get reactionary, or they would use it in a way that's not so helpful. So sometimes silence is helpful. So don't feel like you have to tell everyone the absolute truth. Like, what was the movie with Jim Carrey, Liar, Liar, when he suddenly stopped being able just to lie and he would just kind of blurt things out? So, you know, that's an important thing, is have that quality of discernment. Now, truth sometimes can feel very elusive, because part of what keeps it as hard, it makes it hard for us to perceive it, is our own confusion, our delusion, our reactivity. It can get really confusing in this mind and heart. And there's this phrase from the Insight Dialogue people that's called trust emergence. Trust emergence. And if you've ever done Insight Dialogue, it's almost like you're meditating out loud. So you might have a particular question that you reflect upon, and you voice it. And it's a way of almost doing this inquiry that's with, it's like a dialogue, like an out loud dyad process. That's so powerful. But one of the guidelines is to trust emergence. So if you don't know what to say, it's okay to just pause. Just kind of let things arise. And this is one of my favorite ways with trying to make a decision or trying to figure something out. When I can tell I'm confused, I just kind of relax with that, not trying to figure it out, and trust till something starts to arise that actually feels aligned, that feels connected. And then that's kind of has some element of truth to it, and see if I can express that in a skillful way. So truthfulness, it's interesting because all the teachings of the Buddha, the five aggregates, the Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, all these different lists, we can sometimes take it as a concept, something I really believe in. But until we really see it for ourselves, it has kind of a limited relationship to truth. It's learning to actually see it for ourselves. My early training in this whole practice was with my teacher, Rodney Smith, who was the founding teacher of Seattle Insight. And those of you who have been around a while, his early teachings, he didn't really go through some of the classic lists. He was much more focused on kind of seeing the nature of this moment, seeing the nature of self, kind of refining this quality of clarity, of attention. And so that's how I practiced. And then when I started to be exposed to some of the classic teachings, it was interesting. It was like, it was very fresh because I hadn't really heard it in that way. He kind of talked about it kind of in a kind of behind, a different way of approaching it. But as I heard the classic lists, it was interesting to be able to use my own practice to see, is this true in this moment? And it was a very alive practice. I think that's one of the benefits of how much we focus on meditation practice in the West, is that it gives us this capacity to see for ourselves, to actually see in this moment, how does this actually show up? Is this actually true in this moment? We learn to not go into our heads so much, but actually see real time in this body, this mind. Really, what's the nature of the five aggregates? Not as a concept, but as a direct experience. The nature of the Four Noble Truths. We understand dukkha, start to see the origination of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha. Dependent origination, one of the more complex descriptions of how we create the sense of self, but it has all these kind of nuanced levels that we actually explored that over the year teaching theme a few years ago. And each of those different elements, we can really start to delve into to see, what is perception like? What is the sankharas like? What is vedana like? And how does that actually feed into this creation of self? And that's when it starts to become very alive for us. And this becomes more of a realized truth. We see it in our own experience. And this is, I think, so critical because when we see it directly, that's when the transformation happens in our lives. What I mean by the transformation is that this is called insight meditation, is that we see that we've been perceiving life in a way that's not quite accurate. It's not quite true. We see it with a new level of clarity, a new level of understanding. And in that moment of seeing, there's something that shifts in us. It's almost, sometimes these bigger shifts, it's almost like our whole world starts to reorder. Like for me, often it feels like the kind of foundations in my life suddenly don't make sense anymore. They've kind of been shifted in a fundamental way, in a way that leads to more freedom, more liberation, but also there's a disorientation because my life had kind of been based upon those assumptions. And so in my own practice and working with students, when a student really sees something directly, that's when that practice has that transformational power. Like that analogy of the elephant. And if we had lost our sight and we're touching that elephant and we're able to feel one aspect of it, but we just held that lightly. This is one aspect. Then we feel another aspect. We have a bigger perspective. Oh, the elephant is not just the tusk. The elephant also has a tail, also has a trunk, also has skin. And it's in some ways, it's very much like how our practice unfolds. Now, going more into the sense of the absolute truth, so there's the relative truth of this moment's experience, there's the relative truth of our actions, of our, I'm believing this, so this is my projection, or this is my, you know, thought stream that's coming up, or the emotion. But at an absolute level, truth becomes much harder to put into words. It's much harder to define, because it goes beyond, it's really coming out of something beyond words. Because once we place a word on it, it becomes relative. Sometimes words point very directly and very beautifully, and sometimes they also carry a lot of distortion. In the book called What the Buddha Taught by Ruhula, he spoke of how often in the suttas things are defined in the negative. Just like that, you know, refrain from speaking that which isn't true, is that the negative thing, like the non-clinging, the non-contraction of heart, the non-hatred, the non-greed, what that starts to do is it helps us know what it's not, but it doesn't really define what it is. And he was saying that part of the wisdom behind that is if it defined what it was, like let's say the state of awakening, the state of opening, we could define it as this kind of deep sense of non-separation, of deep unity with all things, that there's no reference point to where you are. There's a deep quality of peace. All those kind of words, our minds can have something that it tries to latch onto. Like, I want that. I want to make that happen. But if you talk about it as non-separation, the sense of non-self, okay, so it's not self, so what is it? That pushes us into beyond what the mind can conceive. It's like the mind can still perceive it, but we can't put our words behind it. One spiritual teacher said that the truth is always paradoxical, is always perceived as a paradox to the rational mind. So from the rational mind's perspective, this absolute truth doesn't make sense. It doesn't fit in. This is part of this tradition of the Zen koan, and from our brothers and sisters and siblings in the Zen world, that these koans in the Renzai tradition, you're asked these riddles that you try to solve, you try to come up with the answer. Like the classic one is, what's the sound of one hand clapping? Right? So rational mind is like, well, there's no sound. That's a crazy question. Or what's your face before you were born? Show me your face before you're born. Now, these questions, the rational mind, so your mind just can't answer it. It could come up with some kind of intellectual stuff, but the Zen master will ring the bell and tell you to go back and practice some more. But what happens is you learn to see from the perspective that that riddle was uttered, that statement was uttered. That's that shift of perspective, that shift of perceiving. The shift of locus of where you are. That's a different access to truth. So learning to see things free of our distortions, free of the way we perceive, free of our assumptions. And that's one of the hardest things is we see the world and we think we know what it is. Right? I know who you are. I know who I am. I know how to do this and that. And absolutely, there's a relative functionality with that. But when we believe that as an absolute, we're tying ourselves profoundly to the cycle of suffering. And that's kind of the bottom line, is we tie ourselves very profoundly when we believe it in an absolute way. When we misperceive the relative truth as being the absolute. And that's so much of what meditation practice is. Everything we see carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. And it starts very simply, very easily, that we learn how to connect with the actual sensations of this body breathing, of this body sitting. We start to use it visually. Can I actually see something and see through my idea of this person or that object or this tree or this car to the actual essence of it? I start to learn to do that to myself. that starts to loosen this conviction in our belief of thoughts, which actually profoundly starts to loosen this belief in this sense of self. It's learning to see clearer our eyes so we can perceive what is true in this moment. You know, learning to perceive when we kind of depart from that, when we want to speak something that's untrue, but also allowing the mystery of what is true to start to permeate more and more in our life. All right, can we just sit quietly for a couple of moments? And as we sit in this moment, just notice what's relatively true. Perhaps there's the swirl of thoughts. Perhaps there's the stillness, curiosity, confusion. There's the experience of this body. And as soon as we acknowledge this moment and how it actually is without any agenda, without trying to change it or alter it, it frees up the moment to start to change into something else. So I get to teach for this week and the next two, so we're going to stretch out a little bit around this truthfulness. And so the homework, I encourage you to take that on. It's not meant to be a burden, but just a way to, how do I actually engage with this topic in my life? How does it actually show up? So the homework is, this month, bring extra awareness to times you shade or negate what is true in speech or action. So that little shading of it, like I'm going to say it a little bit differently, or I'm going to negate how things actually are. And notice the internal experience before, during, and after. Okay, notice what comes up for that. Notice how the homework doesn't say, and make sure you judge yourself a lot for saying something that's untrue. Right? So that's not suggested. It's a counterproductive. And in the same way, notice what arises when you align with truthfulness. What does this teach you about this parami? Okay, so we're learning how to actually see this experience of saying something which is true, saying something which isn't true. The more you see that directly for yourself, it won't be this effort to like, oh, I have to say what's true, I have to have this, what is true. It's more like you start to trust this inner alignment. It becomes this, that's why the body is so helpful. Because the body is going to tell you if you're not quite telling the truth. And there's going to be this kind of disturbance or this friction. Vice versa, there can be this alignment. Doesn't mean it's always going to feel good, right? It may be like it's hard to say this because I'm embarrassed by it or I'm ashamed of it. But once I say it, there's this way of alignment. All right, so that's enough for me. We have a chance for any questions you might have around this parami or about your practice. And online, you're welcome to just raise your virtual hand and I'll call on you. And those in the room, you can raise your physical hand, and Cheryl has the mic that she'll bring to you so they can hear you online. Yeah, Austin.
Beautiful talking. Good to see you, Tim.
Good to see you, Austin.
Getting some feedback. But I have a question just about if you could talk a little bit about the cultivation of the qualities that allow us to be more truthful in our with our lives. And what made me think about it was just the courage as in my sit and then in reflection and contemplation about my life that it takes to be with the truth of mm-hmm. our lives. Discomfort in the sit and still choosing or sleepiness and like, no, I'm here. Yeah. I'm sleepy, but I'm also here. There's like a courage or a bravery.
That's right.
And Cheryl and I were joking last week saying, you can't handle the truth, you know. I don't even know what movie is that from,
that's
but
from,
you know, you grow up with it.
It's with Few Good Men, yes.
So it's just, you know, that's what's coming up for me. It's like bravery is one of the qualities or to how to cultivate that kind of bravery. And I had a friend whose father passed away, and, you know, there's the truth of death. It's one of the, is very clearly taught in Buddhism. But it's one thing to be dying and to be with the truth of what it means to be dying as opposed to the idea of in the future I might die.
Right.
Like truthfulness means something very different when you're in the act of dying.
That's for sure, yeah.
And so what are the, like, again, that bravery or what are the capacities and the ways to cultivate those through practice intentionally to be with the truth? I was curious if you just had any thoughts about that.
It's a big question. There's lots of ways we could take that. Could you give me a little bit of an example of one area that you might, maybe you don't have to go into no details, but like what's one area you have struggled with that quality of truthfulness?
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of, I think dying is one that's coming up for me a lot.
Yeah.
You know, just being with that. And I won't elaborate too much about that, the examples of things I've seen where it's like, oh, this is true and will be true for me and what that means.
Yeah. So death is an interesting one to kind of come to grips with, right? And I think it's also helpful to be kind of gentle with ourselves because it can, you have to kind of notice the, I remember, you know, Rodney Smith, my teacher and the founding teacher, as I mentioned, of Sims, death and dying was a big part of his practice and it's a big part of his teachings. So he kind of brought it forth a lot. But, you know, he also realized that sometimes it was too strong to kind of open to all at once. And so it's kind of like learning to find a way that the mind can start to accommodate to it. I think that's one of the benefits, if you will, of like a chronic illness that's kind of a slow decline into death. It gives the mind and body a chance to really accept this reality because it's really hard. It's like, you know, death seems so far away, you know, something tragic could happen, something violent could happen without, you know, for any of us, boom, we're just gone. But the kind of the slowness of it allows us to start to accommodate to it. So what I often suggest is finding a way to open to it that's not kind of traumatizing or doesn't like make things too scary. So one way to play with it is it just notice kind of the endings of the things. Notice how things have a natural lifespan. And if you try to hold on to it, there's a struggle with that. There's a certain suffering that comes from that. And you also start to see that there's this kind of cyclic movement. It's something falls away and it comes back up. You know, rises in a different form. There's a, you know, we can see it in our own minds. If you look carefully, you know, there's this mind state. I might feel really mad this time. And then something shifts and a new mind state comes up. Because you're so focused on the arising of stuff, we don't notice the ending of things. So that's one way to play with it. Another, you know, the classic one is the five reflections that you know, everything I cherish, I'll be separate from. You know, that I am also the nature of getting old, of getting sick, of dying. And so just kind of reflecting on that. I like to do this when I see someone who's, you know, older than me and not as able as me, just reflect that may be my future. You know, that may be how, that's where they're going, where they are right now, I will be in their footsteps. And so it just kind of brings a little bit of that kind of soberness around it. That's how what the Buddha helped is start him on his practice. His path really is those heavenly messengers of old age, sickness, and death. They realized, oh, I am too of that nature. And that helped him kind of become less enamored with his health, with his, you know, his youth, his power. It's not like you don't take care of those things, but just realize that this is not going to be here forever. Yeah. So a lot of it is just kind of keeping some relationship to it. As you do that, also be aware that there can be this, the real grief of losing people. Just like your friend who lost their dear one. It's like there's the loss of that relationship, and there's all the ways you can have healthy grief around that. So it's a really big topic, but it's very profound. All right, thank you, Austin. All right, anyone else? Or they're so aligned with truth, it's like, yeah, I never lie.
Never Actually, struggle. There's something that I wouldn't mind bringing up on Thursday night. I did a talk on truthfulness, and a lot of the questions at the end were about authentic self. Well, a lot of, not even questions, but what is that? In fact, one of them was Austin that kind of brought this up, you know. What is my true self? And then later I was thinking, what's a self? And I should be practicing non-self. So where does authentic self fit in with non-self? Does that make sense to you in any
sure,
way?
Sure, yeah. Okay. The authentic self, non-self, what's the dynamic between those two? You know, how do we manifest the authentic self? We're trying to manifest non-self. You know, it's like it's a paradox there. Well, it's interesting because there's kind of, again, there's this relative reality and there's the absolute. So the relative world that we have these senses of self, which are always arising and passing away, right? But when they arise, we think that's who I really am. And then we kind of do this connect the dots trick that all those other past senses of self are really just continuous, right? But we start to practice. And we start to have some insight into this. We see that there's actually something that's outside of that limited sense of self, right? So once we start to see that, we start to hold that sense of self less firmly. We don't believe in it in an absolute way. We know that there's an inner emptiness around it. What allows, it's actually paradoxical, allows us to be much more authentic in that sense of self, which is arriving and manifesting right here, right now. And this, in the, our tradition, it's one of the things I don't think we, you know, developed as well as some other traditions is kind of this expression of the authentic self. Like you see in some traditions, like some Tibetan traditions and some Zen traditions, there's this relationship to art, you know, whether it's music or, you know, flower arranging or sometimes martial arts. And there's this sense of fully being there, full-hearted, while you're really engaged. We kind of have that in our culture, like being in the zone, being really, you see an athlete or like watching the Olympics, when they're really connected, there's everything else, they're fully embodying that. And I would say that's, they're expressing that authentic self, you know, as they're doing that. They probably, you know, may believe in that, but they also realize they can't, the more they chase it, the more it goes away. But there's also the authentic self that comes up when you're doing something that feels very personal. You're maybe having a lot of tenderness or there's a lot of sorrow or fear and just that willingness to be vulnerable, to actually show that. You know, and so that's, I think the sense of self, we have to be mindful of the tendency to try to jump over this human realm. It's like one teacher said it, the most important thing is to transcend the sense of self. The other most important thing is to fully be human.
Right. Yeah. to notice the contraction of self and to allow the self to open up and flourish, you know, more confidence. That's what I feel in there. The confidence of, you know, being present.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, there's a lot of confidence, yeah, that comes from that presence.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Cheryl. Yeah, Monica?
Thank you. So a couple of times during the talk, I think I understood you saying that sometimes when we're not sure of the truth and we have a lot of conditioning around it or biases or, you know, extra thoughts that are really kind of either blurring or falsifying things, the way to go is to the body and to how we experience, you know, the truth there. And first of all, was that something you tried to say or said?
I probably tried to say that.
Okay.
But, you know, there's also, you know, sometimes the body isn't, you know, sometimes the body holds a lot of pain. It holds a lot of memories, too. So it's not always 100% the right direction.
That was going to be my question, because sometimes the body also lies. So, you know, I guess then the question is, where do you start to untangle this from, if not the body? Because I really like the answer for the body. It does feel more honest, but it's also kind of not very, you can't ask it questions.
Well, you can, in a way, ask it questions. And this is, for example, let's say I have a choice of saying one thing versus another thing. I'm going to say it kind of in a slow way, but you can do it very quickly. I'm going to say something like, I went to Mom Baker with my family. Okay, so as I say that, I feel this sense of kind of contraction in my chest. I don't know if you'd notice, but my body can actually do this a little bit. So like the body's kind of reacting to that untruth. I said I went to Mount Rainier with my family, which I did. There's a sense of kind of settling. There's a sense of connection. You know, there's a kind of, it's things like align up versus unaligned. That's kind of one way I experience it. So you kind of just notice what the body's reacting to those choices. Because sometimes I say something and I've said it and then my body's like doing some kind of gyration and realize, oh, maybe that wasn't quite true. And then if I'm able to, I try to correct that right then and there. You know, so that's one way the body works. But the body, certainly, if we have a lot of history, like chronic pain is one example. Let's say we have a chronic shoulder pain. It's not just the sensations. There's all our memories, and there's all our projection to the future. There's all the sense of who am I going to be if this shoulder, I can never lift it again. All these things kind of add on to this experience. So in that case, you might just ask, what do I believe is true right now? What am I believing is true? And just let that trust emergence, allow that to start to reveal itself. I'm never going to be able to lift my shoulder again. Okay, how can I know if that's really true?
So that's a thought. It could be a lie. It's not the feeling in the body, right?
Yes, it is a thought and it could be a lie. but also it could be wisdom coming forth, right? Because if thoughts are always lies, then everything the Buddha said that we have recorded, we should just throw that out, right? Because those are all thoughts he had. There's all ways he articulated how things are. So it's more like you learn to see what thoughts are kind of really aligned more with truth. And the investigation question is more like directing your attention. What do I know is true in this moment? What do I believe is true in this moment, and allow that to show itself. So what's happening, there's a part of you that's stepping back and observing that whole thing. It's almost like you, like one of those wishing well, you say, okay, what do I believe is true in this moment? And then, oh, I believe I'm this. It's like, okay, then I could actually, it goes from being unconscious to being more conscious. And then we can work with that. And then I often see a deeper truth underneath that.
I really appreciate the fact about stepping back and observing. That seems like a way into that.
Exactly. Yeah, because if we're in the middle of our thoughts, we don't have any perspective with them, then it's easy to kind of be deceived or tricked by them. But we're able to step back and say, okay, that's a thought's arising. Yeah, that thought has a lot of history, has a lot of momentum. There's a lot of power behind that thought, but I'm observing it. Thank you, Monica.
I'm not really sure if this is a question that has an answer or there's sort of this weird phenomenon that happens to me some mornings when I wake up and I find myself reminding myself who I am. Like, how do I describe this? Like, I am a wife and mother, and I have these particular values, and this is on my agenda today. And I guess it's a very surreal feeling, and I'm not sure if who I was before I reminded myself of these things was me, or if all the things I'm reminding myself of is me, and it's probably both. So it's just a, what's true? They both are probably.
Yeah, it's part of it's the relative truth versus the more the absolute. So before you, so you wake up and you feel less defined. You're not quite sure what this is, but you're still, right. Something's knowing.
It's not uncomfortable. Yeah. It's not a scary feeling. Yeah. It's just I have to reorient myself to the, you know, the human dimensions of my life.
What you might play with is seeing how lightly you can do that. For example, is it possible, because it's kind of like a foreground, background thing, is that you wake up and there's this background of non-definedness. There's a sense of probably, you know, what you are isn't so clear, but yet there's a sense of connection. There's a sense of presence that's there. And then we go to the foreground, okay, I got to assert being a wife or being these different roles I put into it. And how then this other thing kind of gets forgotten in a way. It kind of disappears. Once if you kind of kept that to the foreground while you're doing these different roles and have, you know, have some trust that maybe, what would it be like today if I didn't actually load up that sense of me? What would it be like if this sense of emptiness danced through this chore, washing the dishes or going to the job or whatever it might be? What would it be like if I just allowed that to lead?
As long as I could still function and I wouldn't just crawl back in bed. Yeah, I know, but I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, it's like the crawling back in bed. I mean, sometimes, I mean, there's like the relativeness, like if I wanted to really manifest something in my life, I really wanted to achieve something, and it's like, okay, this is my goals, these are my intentions, I kind of load that up, it helps align my day, and, you know, that allows great things to happen. And from a spiritual perspective, ultimately that's going to end too, just like with Austin's question, eventually that's going to die also. So is that, you know, so kind of play with that. Can I just, you know, some do low stakes, you know, maybe don't do heavy machinery and just try to be non-defined about it, but try to be, you know, something that has really low stakes. So maybe.
So kind of like not really taking it 100% seriously.
Yes.
But realizing that it's a role.
And that's a good way to think of it. Like, how seriously do I take it? Let's say on a 1 to 10 scale. Usually we're about a 10, drop it down to maybe a 5 or a 4 or a 3 or a 1. So just is kind of this light perspective. So that's almost allowing the navigational self that still knows how to do things, but there's this deeper perspective that's there. And from the mind's perspective, the normal way of viewing, that just seems impossible. How can I function? How can I do my job without being fully in my sense of self? But once you start to get that openness into that sense of self, that starts to fall away, you realize it actually frees up so many things. Because that sense of self is kind of clunky. It's kind of constrained. You know, I sometimes use that example of, let's say there's a fire, let's say you're a firefighter. And, you know, you go into a burning building, you put on your bunker gear, your helmet, your mask, your air tank, you got your axe. And that's really helpful when you're in the smoking building. But if you're going to, you know, to a nice restaurant or you're going to a birthday party, that it doesn't serve you so well to have all this gear on. And so that's what happens. The sense of self is like doesn't want to let go of its identification. When you start to see through that sense of self, it just kind of sloughs off. It's like, it's not, I don't see, I know that is not my essence. So that's really the quite this part of this absolute truth. Who are you really? Are you your thoughts, your identity, or is there something, are you something that dies, that is born and die, or are you something that transcends the death? Are you something that's always present?
That term navigational self is really helpful, I think. Thank you very, very much.
Yes, it's part of it's trusting that that's going to be there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Christina Philman once shared that when she was teaching here, and I think that's a really helpful perspective. All right, anyone online have any questions? Anyone back here in person?
We've got two people.
All right.
No, no, you're fine.
Hi, my name's Ben. Relatively new here, but very glad to be here. I have a question that I think fundamentally everything you shared would be absolutely compatible with the orientation of this question, which is about truthfulness at work. I mean, you gave some great examples of truthfulness in our personal lives, and yeah. I think those are really rich environments for aspects of ourselves. But I think what I see it in the work environment are certain norms. Certainly in my work environment, there's certain norms, and I think there's also certain sensitivities.
Yeah.
People feel like they're on display a lot. Their work is maybe being judged. And so there's kind of a different element of truthfulness, and I would just be curious to hear if you had commentary on this topic in that environment.
Yeah, so I like to always be as practical as we can, because sometimes we have these kind of ideal qualities we think we try to project into the world or into something like a job. So if you have a particular culture of that work, it's like you just try to mesh with it. You try to blend with it and act within that. But the difference is how much do you believe in it? You know, how when it pushes, because each culture is going to have the times when it doesn't work so well for you or kind of pushes against you or negates you. And how much do you really believe in that? You know, one example is if we travel to another country, let's say they drove on the other side of the road and they have different cultures. You know, as from this culture, we're going to say that's, you know, it's going to be a different way, but we can kind of adapt to it and get used to it. But we know there's other ways of being in the world. So it's similar to that when you're in the work environment. It's like, okay, this is the way I have to show up and how to be in the world. But the less you truly believe in it, then that starts to change how fixed you are with it. You're more able to adapt and kind of blend with it as make adjustments. Because that's the thing about any culture, any sense of rules, sometimes they really change, right? You might have a coworker who's just lost a loved one, and suddenly the normal rules don't make any sense. And to be able to shift, that's actually quite a big asset. And there's also ways you can maybe start to tweak the culture a little bit by being authentic, being connected, being, you know, being listening, praising others. If everyone's trying to show their own work, like praise them, and then that starts to change the dynamic. So that gives you the freedom to start to play with it. Yeah. All right.
Hi. Something I believe Monica said struck a chord with me, and so I'm not sure if I have a question, but I just was curious to hear your thoughts. Do Throughout your talk, you kind of mentioned that our bodies generally know what's true, what feels true. And Monica said that our bodies also lie. And so I was thinking about that and just like all of the emotions in the body and all of the sort of like unknown things. And when people lie, or like me myself, when I have lied, sometimes I've lied like because I've felt fear mm-hmm. of consequence or like introducing pain.
Right.
And so I guess my question is, when your body knows what's true and your body also has all these other feelings, which like might you might feel like persuaded to align with untruthfulness, how do you like acknowledge fear or whatever might cause you to lie and then like align with truthfulness?
Say that last part again, how fear can help you align with untruthfulness, like just the relative situation.
Yes. I was saying that like in some circumstances, like fear of being truthful, like consequences that mm-hmm. might come from truthfulness. How do you, like, say you stole or something and you're trying to then later come clean, but you're afraid of consequence.
Right.
How do you align with truthfulness while also acknowledging whatever is the source of your cause for untruthfulness, if that makes sense?
Yeah, this makes sense. And that's part of the journey of it, is that it's often there's a lot of work that goes on behind or before you actually maybe express something that's sensitive like that you really feel kind of hesitant around sharing it. And some of that might be like exploring, you know, from a kind of archaic perspective, what you learned around that, or a sense of shame, or a sense of, and sometimes it just clear discernment. Sometimes it's better not to say something that's true. It's better to lie a little bit to protect yourself. If there's a lot of consequence, that's, you know, we can go into lots of different scenarios around it. And I probably would reframe that the body always knows what's true, more like the body's almost like a Geiger counter, that it kind of gives you feedback. Like the more untrue you get, there's maybe more static in the system. Well, when you're more true, it's a little bit more clear feeling. Sometimes it's more like, ooh, if I say this, I'm going to feel ashamed of it, or I'm afraid of what's going to happen. So part of it is just, you kind of, it's like, it's just more information that's coming up. And so you might, you know, if there's something that you want to share or something that feels like it's kind of risky, just having discernment too, is it really beneficial to share this? Is it beneficial for the person to hear it? Yeah, so it's not just only say what's true, it's also having discernment about the beneficialness of it and the timing of it too. And the body just gives you more information. If we, you know, it's not always though.
Thank you.
You're welcome.